All right, yes, we are live. Very good. About 10 a.m. here, August 18th, 2022, coming at you from beautiful Belgrade, Serbia. Yes, indeed, on this Thursday morning. My wife just gave birth to our son this morning. Yeah, about a good number of hours ago now, 4 or 5 hours ago. So I'm here with my daughter. If you hear a toddler doing toddler stuff, that's going to be that. So today we're talking about Putin and the globalists, and it's a subject that comes up a lot, not because there's like a new story or new information that would tend to, justify some, revisitation of the subject, but rather we get the same, I think, similar, same questions arise, and we've talked about, where people get these ideas from. And that they're not stupid ideas to assume that Putin is a globalist. But the thing is, one would need to understand sort of, and I hate to say it like this because it sounds a little dickish, but sort of like how the world works and what people's expectations are in political processes, or how that kind of all comes together. And if one, if a person didn't understand in the first place what the aims and intentions, the mixed and divergent aims and intentions of the various pillars of power and, what they call modern Russia, then you would understand that the process that we've seen doesn't point in this, obvious direction of Russia's part of some globalist conspiracy. And we've talked about things like conspiracies, and we've talked about strategic activity and things like that, and under what conditions it's even useful to speak in terms of the globalists. If we imagine, how you imagine power structures, how you imagine membership in some kind of a thing, or whether what you're talking about is some of that, but also, and probably mostly for most technocrats involved, they're just, unexaminedly, this is what everyone says, this is the direction of things, the rise of multinational corporations. Remember, you used to talk about the TNCs, the transnational corporations, the whole, even back in the 60s, in the 70s, you would have like, maybe like Noam Chomsky, or later even like Ralph Nader, kind of from the consumer end, talking about globalization, quality, environmental stuff. Because a lot of these countries that the US was sourcing for goods and services don't have the kind of environmental regulations that the US has. So it, you could say, made them more competitive in addition to other things, right? So in assessing and trying to understand where people are coming from, I keep noticing a similar theme in looking at, say, a figure like Trump and a figure like Putin. And for what it's worth and for what's visible, and in terms of results that you can enumerate today, obviously Putin has been much more successful along that rubric than Trump, right? But the same, still, you get the same kind of thinking. And it's interesting, you know, it's the expectation that presidents like should be dictators, and that if they're going through the political process, and instead of, you know, an all out war, which is another, you know, type of political process, but the normative political process, the prescribed one, you know, that this is inherently problematic. And so that actually makes people very radical, actually revolutionaries, because they're saying, you know, so now you have in the U.S. like conservative revolutionaries who probably are unfamiliar with any of the, you know, thinkers of the conservative revolution in Europe, maybe 100 years ago. But at the same time, you could still say that they're revolutionaries, because you'll have to forgive me just a second. Evita, these light bulbs broke on us yesterday when we were playing with them. Remember, Daddy said we don't play with light bulbs? People are like, what the hell, dude? You know, if you've ever had toddlers, you know. Okay, where were we? Yes, indeed. So that actually makes them revolutionaries. And what also I've noticed is that, so that's just not understanding how power works, because you think that the guy gets elected and then he just says this is the law or something. But in the case of Putin, you have, on the one hand, he's been there for like 20 years. So obviously that's more than, you know, maybe the most ideal, let's say like three terms that Trump could have had or something like that, whatever your assessment of all that is, but could have had three terms. That still wouldn't have been the length of time, you know, Putin being in there. Much younger to begin with at the start of it all and all that. So also, I mean, we're not trying to compare the two people, but Putin is far more extensive direct experience in sort of this espionage stuff and that type of strategic thinking. I'm not saying that Trump wasn't involved in things and involved in plots throughout the decades, but that's not the same thing as like organizing them and things like that. But who knows? I mean, I don't know to what extent he was involved in organizing these things, but we just would, I guess, presume, and maybe making an error, but just presume that he did. So, and I would say that he didn't. It's just a different area of training and experience and work and life, right? Real estate mogul, you know, intelligence officer, not the same thing. So I think through that lens, but outside, there's this other tendency, like in how people think, that we don't normally address in looking at how we assess things. And that's that other societies, like other countries, always appear to us as much more monolithic and homogeneous than they really are. You know, it's this polarization, as if like Russia is a conservative country in the sense that, you know, old conservative, I don't know, whatever that means, whatever the image in your mind is, you know, conception of a society, you know, like Russia's a country with, you know, hookers and strippers and drug dealers and, you know, football hooligans and stupid variety shows and tabloids and, you know, crap and, you know, just like every, you know, like a lot of other things, right? But it's a sovereign country, and it's not like it's not a Christian fundamentalist state. It's not against the law to be gay in Russia either. There's like a lot of things that people kind of think, and only when you compare it to this like really weird phenomenon in the far West, right, only where they're trying to actually say like the new definition of goodness, of virtue, actually is to be human being, transhumanoid, a post humanoid or whatever, that the virtue is in that. It's not because of the struggle that defines your existence is inherently ennobling, and that's the whole leftist morality play, right, that Nietzsche constantly is attacking. So these ideas and these are not new things. You know, we can examine all of these, the same kind of thing in the 19th century. And when you look at power structures from the outside looking in, it always looks, that's why headlines like, for example, in the Syrian conflict, you know, Syria is a country, millions and millions and millions and millions of people, right? Different governors, different states, okay, different mayors, different police chiefs. And if any given governor, mayor, police chief, or whatever did a craziness, or a craziness could be pinned on him, and both of those things would happen. International media, right, would say the Assad regime, blah, 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 as if like the president of a country is involved in reviewing every fucking goddamn like arrest document from every person in the country, every police department, and that's just not how that works. In societies, it's more complex, right? For example, during the Trump years, did you notice that the typical Democrat maneuver of manipulating the communists and giving them marching permits and $250,000 through Answer Coalition and the Workers' World Party or whatever, the Partido for Socialismo Liberación or whatever, to organize a Democrat anti-Trump, anti-war march? See, that was the whole thing that they did in the Bush years, okay? And the communists, some of them thought that their movement was growing the more that they were just dependent upon, you know, Martin Sheen to pay the fucking mayor or the police department all the fees so that the communists could burn an effigy of George Bush. And it would be mobilized 50,000-100,000 people, maybe 250,000 people, talking about some of the big anti-war marches like 20 years ago. And people really thought that Trump, people on the left really thought that Trump was a problem, but where were the anti-war mobilizations of the Democrat and the communist left against Trump? They didn't exist because there's been a massive sea change and a shift, and the Democrats are much more the party of war, and the Republicans are split. You have the old guard and the Liz Cheney and the neocons and the warmongers there, but the people, Republican voters, the rank and file, many of them union members, many blue collar, mostly middle class, all the entrepreneurs really who aren't suicidal or Andrew Yang, fake entrepreneurs, welfare, champagne socialists, millionaire welfare recipients, like a miniature Elon Musk. You know, but on the outside looking in, these are regimes. But on the inside, you have all the differences. And if people thought, see, the thing is that the CNN and Washington Post, New York Times have been calling Putin a dictator. So then people who are kind of done in their minds, done with the game of parliamentary, you know, musical chairs and passing the buck, in with the old, you know, out with the old, in with the new, same as the old, that kind of shit. That is, this, how to say, has been picked up by people who actually support, you know, Putin. They're like, oh, he's a dictator. Well, that's good. I can give you money. You want cash? Да. Uh-huh. Что? Ого? Mm-hmm. Okay. And the case is just not such that the presidency, he has the power to stay in power, but that's not the same thing as controlling the activity of every human being that has $1 billion in the Russian Federation. Thinking that is going to lead towards all kinds of confusion. So in terms of looking at the World Economic Forum and the things like this, you know, we've gone, despite how that we can discuss the more that we get into the World Economic Forum stuff, the more that we see very quickly that it doesn't hold up. And you basically have to be somebody that goes around talking about what an evil liar and, you know, demonic spawn, and every word out of his mouth is deception and a spell, you know, Klaus Schwab. But then when he says, you know, Putin was a, you know, he made it sound, he didn't directly say it, but it was in the same sentence. And maybe you could say there was a comma that didn't publish or whatever, but sounded like he's trying to say that Putin was a, like a young, whatever, World Economic Forum, young leader, whatever, which is impossible by the years and the age of the guy and the process and the things that have been done and the you know, but, and yet we believe Klaus Schwab at that moment in time. And I pointed to a greater problem phenomenon in political thinking and in political psychology is that you know, the first kind of step of wisdom, but it's kind of like a half-baked wisdom, is in thinking that they're only lying to you when it sounds good. It's a pretty, you know, safe place to, you know, to be. I mean, it's a survival thing. I can see that. It's sort of like, you know, if it sounds good, they're lying. Okay. But then when it sounds bad, you're like, yep, that's what they're doing. That's what they have the power to do. That's what they're going to enact. And you're the one actually recruited into casting that spell, if that makes sense, or your prayers. You're actually, or it's like a negative reverse prayer or whatever. And you're actually bringing that to life. You're actually bringing it into the world in that way. And even if you weren't, you're still misunderstanding an objective, you know, empirical process unfolding in the world before you. So I just look at, wow, you just poured the entire bag of cornflakes next to the bowl. Bravo. Here, let me. So I look at it not from the lens of, how would you say, a political process that hasn't worked, or a political process that has failed in terms of like Russian leadership and its relationship with the World Economic Forum. Once you're past the mythology about the World Economic Forum's scope and what it actually does, I think that there's a bizarre misunderstanding that's never, it's not part of how the World Economic Forum functions or something like this, but that as if they've trained these mind control agents and stuff from this young leader's like indoctrination camp or something. And then they're sleeper agents that are going to vote, you know, for the globalist angle And that's just not how the process works at all. Like there's no connection to reality. There's actually two types of kind of things going on with the young leaders. There's kind of a thing that actually are young leaders that are, is a different program for that's, I mean, it's all bullshit, but I'm just saying what it is. And like, it sounds a little less kind of crazy and stuff. I mean, it's nefarious in terms of their intentions, of course, but just how the benign aspect of it should also be appreciated, just in terms of like they find whatever, an up and coming 24-year-old, you know, chemist from Nigeria who's a female or something, and then they're like, oh, this is a young, you know, whatever, and that's sort of like how it is. And those are the people that might attend like a forum or these seminars and stuff. Okay, then they just have these annual awards that they give out. And it's sort of like, are you going to do a Marlon Brando and show up, or have a, you know, fake Native American show up and like reject the award? Or are you just going to accept the award, or like, okay, duly noted, I've received some award. The World Economic Forum has given me some award, you know. Would you need to go out of your way to withdraw your, you know, did someone, did someone like submit, you know, your application or propose that you, you know, be nominated for whatever? Do you have to be involved in that process actively to be nominated? Probably not. But when you look at how people have, you know, misperceived the World Economic Forum, also misunderstood the relationship to the UN and what the UN is. And no, there's all kinds of things going on. There are people who think that the UN was created by Klaus Schwab or something like this, right? I mean, so there's a lot of confusion about where these institutions come from and like, you know, where, what the thinking behind them was. And you'll often find that just like in many other spheres in political life, there were different intentions from different parties. And it was what the thing that came into existence was some type of, you know, compromise that represented the balance of things. And for countries in the developing world that had these leaders that for the first time maybe had to actually were considered to be more directly responsible to the people, because you're talking about post-colonialism. So now all these countries are no longer administered by the French or the British, et cetera. So nominally they have their own leadership, and now you have this thing called the UN. It's not like the League of Nations, which had a little bit kind of combination of great power countries in how they did that was different from the UN Security Council system. The structures of the UN are kind of also based upon a criticism of the League of Nations, but much of those things, those criticisms and the language of the UN legitimately reflects a lot of these countries' like desire for sovereignty. So it isn't like the UN language and these charters is meant to trick us to think that it's one thing when it's another. It's just that there's a fight over what these institutions mean and what they should be doing. Okay. It's not like a conspiracy to make the institution and how the institution operates today is how it was envisioned to operate by some cabal. That's not how the UN came into existence. So not understanding the purpose of transnational or supranational organizations and forums, and the expectation that leaders are supposed to be representatives. It's not actually wrong for a position of a leader to change over time if the opinions of the people have changed over time also, by the way, because you're elected to represent a mandate. You're not elected necessarily for your own wisdom to change your political positions at will, or to stick to them even if you've lost that mandate and the public wants something else now. You see, that makes you a tyrant. So the idea that there's been changes, you know, over time and in Russian law or whatever, that, you know, Putin has, you know, only further done things that are popular, you know, just to stay in power, is a mentally retarded way of understanding political processes. Elected officials precisely fucking should be altering and changing their stated, you know, agenda in reflection of the people saying we need to, you know, change the agenda here. So in other words, you don't change your principles, but in pursuit of those principles, and one of the main principles being to represent a nation, these nations are made up of not one single Borg consciousness. It's not a regime, you know, it's not a monolithic society in the way that it's, you know, the way that we sort of orientalize foreign lands. We think that all the people do things one way, or that everyone agrees with how things are done there, or that everyone's part of it, or that the president or the king or whoever is responsible for every, you know, jaywalking ticket that was handed out wrongly. And that's just not how countries operate. And how countries do operate, and, you know, the real Russia story, I mean, to the extent that that the Soviet Union lacked access to Western markets, right? They had actually had undergone many internal market reforms beginning in the Khrushchev era. That was the foundation for, you know, people's many communist activists siding with the Chinese surrounding the Sino-Soviet split, is to also criticize Khrushchev's internal policies, which introduced market competition and the between enterprises of the same type, and also allowed managers to have the right to actually fire employees. Whereas before, so that has a immediate, like, kind of individualized pressure on performance. So there had been a lot of things that were profound orientations, not only towards market mechanisms internally, but in adjusting a ghost plan so that the types of things that they were subsidizing macroeconomically were not so grossly disproportionate or long-term unsustainable. Right. I mean, of course, you can, like, if you're a big retailer or something, you have like a loss leader. Right. And you can think about production that way, too, and subsidizing different things, because there might be things that would be, you know, costed badly for in relation to people's real need. Right. So, but generally, what did reformers and what did people who didn't want to live in this system, the Soviet system, right? What did they want, right? Well, they wanted integration into the broader, you know, Western economy, and believed in some of its core tenets, and thought that the things that they were, that the corporatism that they were seeing in the West was, you know, free markets, and that this is what they wanted to be all about, because it was, you know, the Soviets had been calling the West corporatist and fascist for a long time. Okay. It was the West that was saying about itself, like, hey, this is capitalism, democracy, freedom. So people who rejected the, like, Russians and Soviet citizens who rejected the Soviet official position that the West was fascist, instead tended to believe the West's own claims about itself, that it was, you know, the light on the hill, the freedom, you know, whatever, the world, and all that stuff. And so then wouldn't it be the normal thing that the, bravo, you did that all by yourself, you didn't even mention that you were going to go pee, I'm so impressed. These my daughter had another successful pissing, so that's good. On her own, you know, totally unassisted, underwear the whole nine yards. You know, it's amazing. We're like, okay, yeah, kid just took a leak. Yes, 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 that's right. This kid took a leak, though. We were talking about misunderstanding how vectors of power work in a society, and to what extent, you know, the mandate of any post-communist, legitimate post-communist Russian government, there was a twin mandate, okay? And that twin mandate was basically the compromise political position that Russia was able to land and kind of save. It became the foundation for the Russian political theorist, actually, who was the one behind the kind of the official thinking, Surkov, and the idea of a sovereign democracy, right? Sovereign democracy. There's a little bit of a dog whistle in there for those who are used to hearing them. But so anyway, that actually became the thinking, and then like 2 years ago, officially it was announced that Russia's moving out of the sovereign democracy stage. And everything in the last 2 years has been, you know, more an official version of actions that reflect that shift away from sovereign democracy. So what were the main tenets of sovereign democracy? Well, we said it was a compromise, and we had to redefine the political map of Russia, right? So in the period of the collapse of the Soviet Union, you had westernizers, which also meant modernizers, okay? You had different types of far right, from traditionalist, Slavo, Russian supremacist, or clerical fascist, or whatever type of these words that get thrown around. I'm just using the CNN language, like Pamyat and things like this. Okay. You had the, obviously, the, what do you call them? The old guard, the holdouts, you know, is it that Western word? Communist holdouts in that Harrison Ford movie where he's in that hostage situation on the plane. I just vaguely remember, you know, I was in a hotel room or something, and don't ask me much more about hotel rooms though, but what you had was the terrorists were like communists. They were considered far right, ultra nationalist communists. And you're like, what? These are the old guard. These are the communist holdouts. And that's what was considered the far right wing, the communists. If you actually get into media, well, hello, am I being like a negligent father? I'm pretty sure that toddlers should not be behind toilets playing with the scrubber. Here, let's put this right there, and then here, take my hand, let's go out of the bathroom, because we don't use this toilet, do we? Here, okay, you want to close the door? Bravo. Okay. And these communist holdouts are called far right wing. But the actual political map, that's food for thought, and there's layers of elements of truth to this. So you have the political spectrum, and what were the tasks connected to the unstated aspects of this the sovereign democracy? What actually had to do, okay, is it had to take the Western version of, you know, deep, you know, the Western version of deep ethno romanticism and maybe some antiquarianism and things like that associated with fascism, but it was overtly this project from the West from transatlantic like structures, this intelligence, NATO intelligence stuff, doing what was what we call Gladio B, like Gladio, but B for the Central Eastern Europe post-Cold War. It escalated a lot, but these things were the part of the plan for what you saw in Ukraine and the Canadian expatriate community and all of their connections. That's all in Gladio B, just as a frame of reference to conceptual, to visualize that. And there were a lot of far right, westernized far right elements, and so much that you couldn't untangle the map. So in other words, the operating theory in sovereign democracy theory is to simulate a pluralistic multi-party system, to simulate political contests, and to represent all of the real existing political forces in what they call modern Russia, that had been, which in reality had been shaped largely by Western interference into the Soviet Union in terms of support, like trying to give shape to the anti-Soviet sentiments and resistance and underground letters and things like that. Because being against the problems in the Soviet system, it's actually not obvious that some other society holds the answers. Just by the way, you could, in the field of Soviet dissident studies, you had like authors like Yevtushenko and people like this that were kind of propped up in the 60s, 70s and stuff like this. It's a whole field. There's texts like Prospects for a Future of Soviet Society and things like that, Western texts, and they look at all these things. So that's in the field of Sovietology. Wow, that is a lot of cornflakes. I think that then you can see the dilemma in trying to, force this to fit the case in Russia, that it's, simply one thing or another. So people don't allow for the concept of struggle or conflict or nuance or multiple contradictory processes happening simultaneously. People just somehow don't have that. They want it to be like either Russia is, anti-globalist, or they're, part of the matrix. There's no thinking that, can we assess the trajectory of the leadership versus the trajectory of the elites? From what point of view can we explain the last several decades of mass arrests and assassinations of different oligarchs, right? If there wasn't shifting of power, consolidation, cleaning house, how do you orient things? And the other aspect, and kind of what was landed on, and we'll come back to sovereign democracy later, but it was really about Russianizing all of the political divisions, which three out of four of them were actually pro-Western, and how to make things that were not inherently pro-Western and reshape them. So we'll be picking up on that next time. For now, I'm out. This has been Joaquin. All right, peace.